Well, good morning and welcome everybody to all of you who are online and to those of you who are with us in our Woodside room. Thankful that you can be together and we can all be in it together. I'm Brian Suter. I'm the pastor of Community Life and Learning, and we are in the eighth week of this series called Honor, Reclaiming What Matters Most in Life. And we've been walking through the Ten Commandments together. Now, perhaps you memorized these commandments as a child or maybe later in life, but a walk through this for me personally has been so helpful. And I trust for you as well. And probably my primary learning is to remember that God has saved us and he gives us these commandments as a way to keep pursuing life in him and not to get sidetracked by all of the ways that will ultimately spell our demise. What God says at the end of the day is this is the way to keep being free. And this is the way to live a full life out of what God has already done. So I want to invite you to take out your teaching notes if you haven't already. And if you have, and if you've looked at the title, you know that today is a big one. And so I hope you got a great extra hour of sleep last night and that this morning you had that bowl of candy from Trick or Treat and that favorite piece of candy was waiting for you when you woke up this morning, and that will help us to go through it. We find the seventh commandment in Exodus chapter 20, verse 14. You shall not commit adultery. Now, in a way, the message could probably be done because it's a pretty straightforward one. We're in a row of pretty straightforward commands, but there is so much more to understand here. Long before this commandment was given, God's best was set in the Garden of Eden. In Genesis chapter 2, verses 24 through 25, it's a beautiful picture of what God has originally given us. And that is says this, "That is why a man leaves his father and mother and is united to his wife. They become one flesh. Adam and his wife were both naked and they felt no shame." And as we read the scriptures, we understand and recognize that this actually gets messed up pretty quick. And so what God is saying in the giving of this commandment, in the living of it for us, is let's go back to the garden in what I originally intended. The Hebrew verb for adultery here is nawaf, a verb that is primarily concerned with marital fidelity. And another way of translating it is to break wedlock. And what we find here is God's intention for love and sexual intimacy that applies for all of us. God is giving us this command to return his people back to the purest, most sacred, and most life-giving expression of this gift of intimacy. But before we go any further, I want to not acknowledge a short list of things that I think build out a very important framework for our journey today. And the first of those things is that marriage is really, really good, and the expression of sexual intimacy in marriage is equally as good because God is good. In the garden, we find that they were united in soul and body and there was zero shame. And in Genesis chapter 3, we see what happens and they fall in sin, and immediately the first thing that they do after that happened was they hid. Shame was overwhelming for them and they hid from God. Yet throughout the Bible, we find a couple things. We find a remarkable, beautiful, grace-filled picture of who God is, because the first thing that he does for them is he provides for their need to help them to cover up their shame and to move into him with it. And the second thing that we find throughout the scriptures is a remarkably positive and powerful view about sex and about marriage and about God's intention to return us back to shame-free, joy-filled, life-giving, and sustaining Genesis 2 intimacy as God intended. Tim Keller, author and a pastor, reflects on this in his book called The Meaning of Marriage, and I recommend it to you to read it because it's an excellent and helpful read. He says, "The Bible says no unity with someone physically unless you are also willing to unite with them emotionally, personally, socially, economically, and legally. And once in that marriage, sex is a way to maintain that covenant." He goes on to say, "It is perhaps the most powerful God-created way to give your entire self to another human being. It is God's appointed way for two people to reciprocally say, 'I belong completely, permanently, and exclusively to you.'" And to close up his comments, he said, "You must not use sex to say anything else." And part of the reason why, amongst many different reasons, is because we belong to God and we are incredibly valuable to him. More valuable than our human minds can possibly ever fathom. Paul reflects on this in 1 Corinthians 6 in verses 19 and 20. He says, "Your bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you have received from God. You are not your own. You were bought with a price. Therefore, honor God with your bodies. Second, we live in a time that does not uphold the covenant of marriage and God's intention for intimacy within it. But as we look at the Bible, that's not a new thing. Our culture's projected view of sex and its misuse is do whatever with whomever, whenever. And there was probably no more stunning of a recent example of this than in the summer, than when the news broke about a website called Ashley Madison. This was a website that promoted people, married people, having affairs out of wedlock, and in fact did so with the mantra, life is short, have an affair. And it promised secrecy, but eventually it got hacked, and secret information supposedly was published worldwide around the world on the internet, and many people were found out living in that reality. What we find here is the reality of every marriage is that it's the product of two people who are broken, but yet two people whom God has intentions for to love each other in the good parts of who they are and in the bad parts of who they are, and to be sanctified or grown to be more like Jesus through the experience of that marriage in a covenanted, genuine, and soul-connected way. Author Ann Voskamp recently wrote a blog post about this topic, and it was intended for her young adult sons who are going into another phase of life into this world, and she said this to them, and we read along. She said, "Your naked body deserves the honor of being shared only with someone who is covenanted to never stop loving your naked soul." Powerful words. Third, this is not a comprehensive message. In other words, we're not going to cover everything that needs to be covered. We just don't have the time. And so what I want to invite you to do is to open up your hearts and your minds to receive God's promptings that he has for you, because I believe that God has promptings for every single one of us. He's present, he's here, he knows us in only the way that he can. And he will give you invitations of what it looks like, not only to receive what he has for you, but then to live it out as you go. And then fourth, I'm going to be super candid. This is uncomfortable. If I have made you uncomfortable with the words that I've said so far, welcome to the party. Because this has been an uncomfortable message for me to prepare. If I could have picked any of the Ten Commandments, this would not have been my first round Jaff choice. There's a lot of other good options too. But then the other thing that I recognize in this is that this is a very difficult conversation, because across the expanse of this room and the Woodside room and those online, this meets for some of us with very deep pain. Pain that we don't know what you may be feeling. And if that be your journey, I pray that you will lean into God with that pain, because he knows you and he knows it and he's with you. And I think here's what has gotten me excited about this message. As a result of what happens here in our church today, I think some incredible things can happen in all of our lives and in our marriages that are represented, and that's a good journey if we can have it. I have the courage to be in it together, and I hope that you can. We're going to be guided by three primary questions this morning, and they're in your teaching notes. And the first of which is this: why do people violate the seventh commandment? Now, there's a lot of reasons, but I want to share a few of them with you this morning. First, by an assumed invincibility. One of the incredible privileges that I never take for granted as a pastor is to stand with people in some of the most life profound moments that you could ever imagine, like weddings or perhaps even like funerals. But in weddings, what we see is this beautiful picture of two people that are going forward. I had one recently. It was in a beautiful old church that had a really long sanctuary with an aisle to match. And what happened was the processional music began and the wedding party started to walk down that aisle. And then the moment that everybody had been waiting for happened, the doors closed, right? Cue the canon in D, and the doors opened back up again, and there standing in front of everybody that was there was the bride and her father, who were silhouetted against the backdrop of these incredible fall trees that were across the city street from this church. You couldn't see their faces. And they walked down the center aisle, and it wasn't until about the middle of the church that you could finally see the expression on their faces. And I said out loud, "Wow." And I looked at the groom, and he's got tears in his eyes. And tears begin to fill the eyes of many people in the sanctuary. Then the groom steps down to receive his bride from her father. And there's more tears that fill people's eyes. And then there's laughter. And then powerful intention translates into covenantal vows. And then they exchanged rings, and then eventually they lit the candle that signified their divine unity. And during that moment, there was an Adele tune that was sang, and it was really a Bob Dylan song, "To Make You Feel My Love." But the soloist ripped the roof off of the place. It was incredible. And the words that were saying was, "I would never do you wrong. I'd go hungry, I'd go black and blue, I'd go crawling down the aisle or the avenue. I'd go to the ends of the earth for you, and no, there's nothing that I wouldn't do to make you feel my love." And in that moment, there was a stunning felt invincibility that they lived in, and it was beautiful. They started in perfection. But the reality is we don't stay there very long, and we can't stay there very long. And the point that I'm making is this: the minute that we think that we are not susceptible to an affair is when we are at our dangerous, most dangerous point. Every single one of us. Many marriage counselors cite that most clients recovering from infidelity thought that they were immune. The exception. And there's just not a more dangerous place than to simply deny our frailty. We have to embrace that. Second, we're prone to drift. So there's the wedding, then there's the honeymoon, and then what happens when couples get back from the honeymoon? Normal. Life gets normal. Normal for Courtney and I is symbolized by a toothbrush. Let me tell you a story that we still laugh about to this day. We'd gone on our honeymoon, we came back, and after our honeymoon, I moved all my stuff into her condo that she lived in by herself for a while. And that was our first experience of living together that night after returning back from our honeymoon post-wedding. And I started to brush my teeth. And we were together at the sink, and I finished, and then I went to place my toothbrush in the drawer. The drawer at which Courtney looked, and she saw all that she had organized, and it was very good. It's her domain, man. And so I put that toothbrush in the drawer, and she said, "You're gonna put that there?" And this look over her face came, and she's like, "You're here forever, aren't you?" And you start just to recognize that there's thousands of adjustments, and we laugh about that to this day. Here's the reality: toothbrushes happen, dishes happen, bills happen, taxes happen, there are lawns to mow, and very soon driveways to shovel. There are kids to raise, there's arguments, and then there's annoying habits. Like the way that somebody in our house clears his throat when he's brushing his teeth. There's resentments and there's patterns and then there's distance and then critical spirits and thousands of little exits off of the highway of marital health. And sometimes we match that feeling with this statement: you know, one day we'll fix that. One day we'll work on our marriage. One day when this or that is beyond us, we'll get to that. And we have to root that out. I reached out to a friend who's a professional therapist, and he specializes in helping people recover from infidelity. His name's Todd Mulliken, and he says this both over the phone and in a book that he wrote: 60% of affairs happen 10 or more years into a marriage. Affairs oftentimes take this long to develop because it takes years for unhealthy and unfulfilling patterns to settle into the marriages. And the point is this: over time, if we do not put a rudder down and steer the ship, we're going to drift into places that we never imagined that we would go. Thirdly, it's closed eyes. An author named Michael Hyatt said in a recent blog, "The only way to justify an affair is to completely close our eyes to the terrible costs that it affects on those who are the closest to us." And he's right. The effects of infidelity are sweeping, and they're dramatic. There's deep fracture in the lives of those closest to you, potentially maybe even costing you your family, financial difficulty, cost of careers and reputations. You know, what's beautifully true is that God's grace can, will, and does cover all of those things and writes a new chapter. But if we could avoid this, if we could only avoid this, there would be some incredible things that could happen. Count the cost. Affairs involve deep pain, generational exhaustion, and that's why God put them in the Big Ten. And then lastly, infected hearts. Another way to say this could be hardened hearts. But in Jesus' words in the Sermon on the Mount, he takes this commandment and levels the playing field for every single one of us because it's more than just a behavior. In Matthew 5, verses 27 through 30, he says, "You have heard it said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than for your whole body to go into hell." Here's a couple points that we make of application. First and foremost, Jesus is most concerned about your heart first. Number one, because in our hearts are where things start. He's most concerned about our hearts here. And here's what's true about God. He has an aim to change the hearts of broken people like me and like you, and he wants to give life. He wants to, in a way that goes beyond our ability to understand it, mold and shape our hearts to be like Jesus's. And he does that over time. He's not a cosmic buzzkill. He's a God that invites life and invites the best way forward. He's showing us a way that we will actually be fulfilled in how he created us. Second, Jesus uses dramatic and figurative language here to say, if your eye causes you to sin, basically don't look. If your hand causes you to sin, then don't do it. If your foot causes you to sin, then don't go there. He's giving us a dramatic way with a lot of weight to say, you've got to cut that out of your life. Don't give in to temptations. When it comes to that, we're reminded of incredible provision from God in 1 Corinthians 10:13. It says the temptations in your life are no different from what others experience. And God is faithful. Isn't that great? God is faithful. He will not allow the temptation to be more than you can stand. When you are tempted, he will show you a way out that you can endure. Next big question, what steps will help us to remain faithful to our spouses? Over the last few months, I've read a lot of ideas, and there are some amazing ideas out there. And what I want to do today is float some ideas out there for you, again, against the backdrop that I believe that God is providing us with some promptings here, and capture one or two of those ideas, and then do your best job with God to live them out in whatever context you go back into, whether that's you're single or whether you're married. First of all, I don't want to be legalistic or prescriptive, and that's one of the best ways that we can engage this, is to listen to God's voice and say, which one do I maybe need most? So first, if you're single, how can you keep God's commandment here? There's a lot of ideas around this, but there are a few that are big ones. First, a prayerful, intimate relationship with God, because he can, does, and will fill that void of longing. Second, a community of trusted friends on the way of Jesus that you can safely and meaningfully process these things with a sense of accountability and genuineness. And then third, examination. What are you seeing? What are you watching? What are you giving yourself to? And is that in God's best for you? And I added one after the first service because a friend of mine who's single came down and said, you know, I've got one more thing that I thought is pretty meaningful for those of us who are in that phase of life. She said, I think it's my job as well to honor all of the marriages that are around me and to give life to them and to protect them. Yes, with my behavior too. And I thought that was so profound that she said that. Second, if you're married, what is your plan to protect your marriage? If you don't have one, that's okay. But as Dr. Seuss says, congratulations, today is your day. This is the day, friends. I think it's a turning point for a lot of us. There's two fields in which we protect our marriages. First, we protect by defending or guarding our marriages. And then I think second, we protect our marriages by pursuing our marriages. It has to be a combination of both. And let me explain why in some of the ideas that I have for you. First of all, friends. If you're married, do you have a group of friends? Or do you have an individual friend of the same gender who can be two things at once for you? First, a safe place for you to process all that you're experiencing and engaging of your faults. You could even potentially say something like this if it were true for you. You know, I'm starting to feel attracted to a person at work and it's really scaring me. It's that kind of friendship that is safe that will engage that with you in a way to help you to pursue Christ. So that's the first part, a safe place. But then secondly, our friends also need to be the kind of friends that if they saw us going beyond the guardrails of God's best, they would risk their friendships with us to tell us at the same time. My hope is that you have that. If you don't, do the hard work of finding it, because it's easier to find that than to go through an affair. There are a lot of small groups of married couples that are meeting together, processing through all the things of life and doing this here at Westwood. And we have new ones that are getting sent out all the time. That would be a great next step. Or pull in somebody that you trust into your journey. Or maybe it's just a single couple friend. Second, recognize any destructive patterns that might be existing in your marriage. Do you have any? Did something pop into your mind maybe when I said that? If so, please have the courage and the strength to be able to identify it, and then not just identify it, but do something about it, because there are amazing people that can help us to navigate through that in counseling and in therapy. I wanna give you a heads up about a resource list that we have on our website if this might be something that you'd like to take advantage of. When you go onto our homepage, across the top, there's a button that is titled Westwood Ministries. And on the pop-down box of that button, there is a button that says Community Resources, and it's a significant list of people who are licensed therapists and counselors that can help you to navigate this stuff. And many people at Westwood have met with these folks and have found their way forward. Third, count the cost. We already talked about this, but here's a way to do that. If you're facing the temptation of infidelity or any temptation for that reason, put a piece of paper down on a table in front of you and write it out how you think that will go. Write out the effects of that, the negative effects that will take place. What will be the impact on your family, in your community, your neighborhood, your work, your financial cost? I think if we do that process, that discipline of examination, and if we're listening to the promptings of the Spirit, we will not want to walk away. We will want to run away because the cost is too heavy. It's too great. Fourth, it may mean that you set appropriate boundary lines with the opposite gender that you can agree upon with your spouse. Not arbitrarily selected, but done in connection with your spouse. It might mean that you guard your devices, your phones, and your computers to ensure that your eyes don't see things that you don't need to see that are at our fingertips. There's great resources like Covenant Eyes and other things that can help you. And then another one, and this is a big one, but to prayerfully guard yourself, to be with God in this, to confess if there are patterns of sin that are there, to receive his forgiveness. And we'll have an opportunity to do that at the end of our service this morning. So if we're protecting by guarding or by defending, we also need to protect by pursuing. As author Carrie Newhoff said recently in a blog post, the goal of marriage is not to avoid an affair. The goal of marriage, rather, is to have the most intimate, passionate, committed relationship that you possibly can with another person. I already mentioned my friend Todd, but I reached out to him and he said one of the best affair-proofing endeavors that a husband and a wife can go through is when the man is pursuing his wife and the wife is accepting her husband. Because there's a pattern that can exist that might go the wrong way, and here's what that might look like. Over time, a husband might stop pursuing his wife spiritually or emotionally or relationally and then begins to think about everything else that is in his life, work, kids, whatever it might be. And the wife begins to not feel noticed. And then as a result, the wife stops accepting her husband and might get overcritical, and that cycle continues until somebody breaks it and says enough. So if that be your pattern, I want to say to you that really good things can happen when you interrupt that pattern and when you head in a different direction. This gets interrupted by both spouses doing both things, yes, but when there's an active pursuit on a part of the husband and an active acceptance given generously by the wife, it's really beautiful. Second, when was the last time that you looked at your marriage vows, that you spoke to one another? Maybe you got married a long time ago, you can't access them, you can't find them, and if that's the case, write some new ones. And remember those vows, those powerful words that you spoke to one another, which God in his mystery blended your lives together in that moment. Remember your vows. Pray them into your marriage. Third, manage conflicts well. This is pursuing your spouse. This is bringing patience and forgiveness and resolution and a new way forward when conflicts happen, because they do. By the way, conflict is a requirement of healthy marriage. It's okay, and it's really good when it happens and when it's resolved well. So maybe that's your next step. Fourth, speak positively about your spouse publicly. Have their picture with you. Speak positively about your spouse to them privately. You know, it's interesting to me. Couples sometimes will select Colossians 3, verses 12 through 17 for their wedding ceremony. And one of the most profound sentences in there is, and always be thankful. When people get married, it's a celebration. But God's call on all of our lives is that be only the end of the beginning of a lifelong gratitude celebration for the person whom God has brought into your life. And then lastly, enjoy each other sexually. Yes, I said that out loud in church. Enjoy each other sexually. Married folks, this is perhaps one of the most holy things that you can do. Participate in this beautiful vision that God has given us in Genesis chapter 2. Naked and bare in body and soul without shame. Because covenantal love gets fueled by the expression of sexual intimacy within that covenant. You are not only allowed in the scriptures, you're very, very clearly encouraged. And there's lots more to that topic. And so I want to point you towards a resource that we have online. Pastor Joel led us through a great sermon series in 2012. You might remember it. It was called Crazy Love. And it was a walk through the Song of Solomon. You might want to consider doing that as a married couple. Listen to that. Or there is a great marriage seminar that we have here. And Dave, I'm forgetting the name on the stage. Thank you, Dave. Dave Troutman. There's a great marriage seminar that comes up on a regular basis called The Art of Marriage, and it's a great step that you can take to begin to pursue all of the dimensions of this, but not only that, this last point as well. Prayerfully guard your marriage. Pray with each other. Pursue one another. Protect your covenant by defending it, and protect your covenant by pursuing it. Great, amazing things can happen. Lastly, what are we reclaiming? You know, sometimes at a wedding ceremony, in a wedding reception, there's a moment that happens on occasion. And it's not every time at wedding receptions that this takes place, but sometimes the DJ or the band invites the bride and the groom to come out onto the dance floor and they dance with each other. But then the DJ says, everybody else who's married, come onto the dance floor. And there's a number of different married couples at many different stages of life who are dancing with each other. And then one by one, the DJ starts to knock couples off. And he says, if you've been married for 1 year or less, get out. 5 years or less, 10 years or less, 15 years or less, 20, 30, 40, 50. And there have been weddings that I've been at where a couple that has been married for more than 60 years is standing on that dance floor dancing together. Often frail in body, but often strong in soul. Together with each other, having weathered the years, having in a very gritty way committed and covenanted to each other, been faithful to one another. And what happens with everybody in that room? Honor explodes to them. There's nothing like it. And that's a beautiful vision of what God is calling us to reclaim here in this commandment, no matter what our stage in life, no matter what our marital status, no matter what things that we bring into this room. Last question, what hope is there if I've violated this commandment? If that be you, knowing that there's a lot of pain, start by receiving God's forgiveness. He gives it to you freely and generously if you're willing to receive it. If you violated this commandment, you can and will be forgiven. God's grace means that there's nothing that we can do to separate us from him, that there's nothing that we can do to make God love us less, no amount of sin or failure, and there's nothing that we can do to make God love us more, no amount of right living or what have you. God's love and his grace simply is, and Jesus died to ensure it. And that's true of every one of us in this room and in Woodside and online. God's grace is for you. This applies if you have been the offender, and this applies if you have been the offendee. And on the behalf of the offender, it takes real, genuine repentance and remorse and reassurance through action over a very long time. And on the part of the offendee, it's choosing over and over again to trust rather than to mistrust and to grant forgiveness generously, even when it's terribly difficult to want to do that. God's grace, though, is not just the reception of his forgiveness when we sin and when we confess it. His grace is the fuel that we need as average, ordinary human beings to do things that we're not capable of doing on our own. So because of God's grace, I believe that some of us need to hear some words this morning, and that is this: God is in the business of making dead things live again. He's in the resurrection business. And that may apply this morning to your marriage. And if that be your case, I want to say, I don't know your story. I don't know what things that you face. It might be a tremendously massive mountain that you must climb. But God will be there, and he will be with you. And he will give you all that you need. My friend Todd, that I talked about earlier, says that couples who prevail, their marriage has never been better. And God's grace meets us in the midst of all that. Every one of us has a table set for us, and we're gonna go to that table. One of the things that I've reflected on recently about the experience that is depicted in the Gospels of Jesus giving these words to his disciples is that he looked at a room full of his disciples, the people that he trusted in the most in this world, and he said these words: "This is my body given for you. This is my blood shed for you. It's a new covenant." And he knew that as he gave them those words, in a matter of hours, every single one of his most close and trusted friends would betray him. And he still did it anyways. And what's even more amazing to me is that he gives me that same exact grace. And that same exact grace is for you this morning. The only thing that is required is to acknowledge your brokenness. And just simply to say, "Jesus, I don't have it all figured out, but I receive it today. I want to be forgiven." And perhaps for the first time, maybe you bend a knee to this Lord who loves you. Or for the thousandth time, you are renewed and remade and reborn. So friends, let's come to this table of radical love and grace that will never quit loving us. Would you join me in prayer? God, on this day, we're thankful for a lot of things, none more than your presence with us in every moment of life, in the moments that are good, in the moments that are hard, in the moments that are comfortable, and yes, in the moments that are uncomfortable. And I pray that for every one of us, that in this moment in which we remember, in which we practice this ancient reminder of your goodness and your grace in our lives, that you will move us today, November 1st, into a brand new way of living, renewed and remade, reborn and made whole. Grant us that grace again. We want to hear from you. In Jesus' name.